You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans. That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
How do you value a cryptocurrency? It seems like the value is just pulled out of thin air by the market. And then you have people saying it's a fad or there's no value to these things. But there is a way to value these things. How do you do it? And furthermore, what's the best way? Is it possible to time the crypto market? I talked to Tasha from Tasha Labs. She's one of the smartest people I know in the crypto space. You definitely have to check out her website, Tasha Labs, and sign up for her newsletter. We talk in great detail, not only how do you value a crypto, not only how you can time the crypto market, but what really are some of the future use cases of crypto that will lead to ultimately a billion users and why this is not just a fad. Again, back in 1999, 2000, 2001, everyone was still saying the internet was a fad. Well, it wasn't. Crypto's going to follow the same path, but let's hear more details. This is Tasha.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
What occupies most of your day?
You know, I consult with projects on tokenomics and on other, you know, projects that work with. I do investing. I also partner with, say, Angel Syndicate, and we do like regular deals. So intro projects and vetting projects. And I have other things that are not Web3 related. I do like consulting in economics, and I also run a software company. So it's just...
You keep pretty busy.
Everything adds up. So, but you know, it's like we are similar in that sense, because I know you're multi-talented and multi-interested in like multiple, like cross-disciplinary, and you are like doing like all sorts of projects as well. So I'm sure you understand.
I think it's a good way to kind of diversify life so that no one thing can take you down.
To me, it's like, you know, my goal is to live to 120 years old. And when I think about, okay, I have all these years ahead, what am I going to do? So I've got to, you know, like have new projects and new investments and new skills that I'm building on. So, you know, to keep life interesting going forward.
Yeah.
So it's not like a typical, you know, traditionally you have a job and you have a career and you stick to that for the 23 years and then you retire. That's just not going to cut it anymore.
Well, you know, and it's funny because I think like if you look at all the science and research on, you know, anti-aging and viewing aging as a disease rather than just an inevitability so that they could actually focus on solving this disease, there is real progress being made all over this industry. And I think it's exponential sort of progress. So it's the kind of thing where it's really small and you like barely hear about it now. But in a few years, it could be this huge thing that's just a natural part of our lives that we get into an anti-aging regimen, whether it's lifestyle or medicine or whatever. I mean, is that why you think you'll live to 120? Because you see the science on this?
Yeah, you know, 120 is the research shows it's the natural human lifespan if nothing like accidental, like, you know, cardiovascular disease or diabetes or, you know, cancer that happened to you, or if none of those things happen to you and you take care of your life, then the natural lifespan should be 120. That's for now. We're not even talking about the scientific advancement that will even, you know, increase that. So I'm an optimist. So you take care of your life and whatever the new scientific discoveries, I'm sure will keep happening. You know, if you look at the next 10, 20 years, I'm like in terms of investment, I'm obviously very, very interested and working a lot in Web3. But another area I'm investing a lot in terms of my time and energy and doing research and also monetary is biotech, you know?
Yeah, particularly like genomics, right? Like genomics is where, you know, the gene editing stuff is where there's room for so many discoveries that could solve so many medical issues.
You look at like Moderna, for example, you know, their claim to fame was the mRNA COVID vaccine, right? But you're like, these days, like they're coming up with news like every other day. It's like, oh, we have this vaccine for, I don't know, lung disease. We have this vaccine for, you know, XYZ. So these things are going to keep happening for, you know, next couple decades. That's what I think.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I do think this stuff like the CRISPR style gene editing is going to be get bigger and bigger. I mean, it's an exponential increase every year since for the past 40 years. And then you have stuff like these, I don't know if you're familiar with these Yamanaka factors that they've been experimenting on mice with and extending, mm-hmm. you know, literally it like resets the clock in mice. It makes the old mice younger. And problem is the mice get cancer after that. So they're still working out the kinks. But there's lots of interesting things happening. Yeah. But crypto, you recently wrote a couple of great articles on, you know, A, how to value any particular token or cryptocurrency, and B, how to time the crypto market. And I thought there were very interesting models you were building. Uh-huh. Maybe we could start with how to time the crypto market, because I think that's very interesting and it's very timely right now. Like we're in a period where right after FTX, every talking head on the news was saying crypto's going to zero. Obviously, like Ethereum is 50% higher or 60% higher than the FTX lows. Bitcoin's almost 50% higher. Like, what's your model and what's it showing? And so, I have questions because I obviously know what your model is.
Okay, all right. So let me just like talk a little bit about what my model is about, which is really, I didn't invent this. It's been existing in TradFi for a gazillion years. It's basically market breadth indicators. It tells you how broad-based a particular market move is, whether it's to the upside and to the downside. So what is market breadth? It means like how many items, or you can think of tickers like stocks or tokens that are participating in a market move. So if the total crypto market cap goes up 5% today, is that because only like a two or three large caps like Ethereum and Bitcoin goes up? Or is it because it's more broad-based, maybe like a 400, 500 tokens all go up? So the empirical fact is it tend to be the case that the wider the market breadth is, meaning the more participation there is in a particular market move, the more likely that it will have some lag. It will have a continuation. It will have last longer, basically.
So just to see if I understand. So basically, you take the number of tokens going up, you look at the number of tokens going down. If the ratio of tokens going up versus tokens going down is above a certain level, you say that the market has kind of some momentum going for it and it will continue to go further.
You know, you can look at this in different indicators. You can calculate what percentage token go up versus what percentage token go down, which people call it advanced decline ratio, for example. Or you can look at, you set a threshold, okay, I only want to look at a bigger move. So I want to look at tokens that go up, for example, 5% in a day. So you look at number of tokens go up 5% versus number of tokens down 5%. You look at ratio and look at numbers. Or you can look at, okay, I want to go maybe like a daily data or hourly data, God forbid, is too volatile. So I want to look at longer time periods. So maybe a week or a month, I look at, okay, this past 7 days, I want to look at number of tokens, how many of them have gone up 20%, for example, versus down 20%. You can look at it's at any interval you want, and that will give you a sense of market breadth. And you can look at different indicators at different time frames and do your own comparison and to come up with some general conclusion of your own that depends to an extent on your own, you know, judgment. And that's one type. The other type is you can look at, okay, the other type of market breadth indicator, for example, you can use like a secondary, like derivative indicators like moving average, right? So you look at how many tokens, what percentage of tokens are above 50-day moving average right now, for example, compared to those that are below their 50-day moving average. Or you can look at, okay, how what percentage of tokens are above the high of the past 1 year or above the high of past quarter versus the percentage of tokens that are below the past low of the previous quarter or previous year. So those give you like indicators of market breadth, right? So if you want to go like statistical about this, then you can look at these ratios and you can, you know, get a longer time series about these ratios and you can calculate like percentiles of these ratios, right? So like, for example, if you look at percentage of tokens above a 50-day moving average, let's say like on a very mediocre average day in the market, that percent is, I don't know, 50% of tokens above 50-day moving average, let's just say. I don't remember what the actual number is. But you notice that once this ratio goes above like 80 percentile or 90 percentile, it's very likely the market will revert. It's just like a mean reversionist market tendency of any market, right? So there are some basic tendency of the market, mean reversion and trends. Those are like a very two basic trends.
They're kind of against each other. So when mean reversion is when something goes too high, it reverts back to the mean and will eventually go lower.
Yes.
Trends are when something is going high, it tends to go higher.
It tends to perpetuate for a period of time until it doesn't.
Right.
So I know it sounds contradictory, right? But you have to judge this when a move just first started, the trend factor tend to dominate, right? So something goes up, it tend to have the tendency to go up more. But after a while, the mean reversion factor starts to set in, right? So this is not something that you can just fully automate and use a computer to to guide your...
But you can a little bit.
You can. That's what these indicators, you know, help you do. And also there are people who do that, you know, completely automate their investment or trading decisions. So I would say it's really hard to do. It's like there is a factor of human consciousness, your discretionary judgment that involved that it's just somehow very hard to replace, at least at this stage. If in the future, like AI becomes so much smarter than humans, I don't know. But right now, it's just like you need human discretions for the most part, I think, you know. So basically, these indicators, like it tells you, okay, is there a trend? How strong is the trend? And like market breadth, it tells you the strength of the trend, right? So, but also you look at these cutoff points, like the higher band, the lower band, for example, we talk about these ratios, like moving average ratios, right? So if at some point in the market, you know, like 75% or 90% of the tokens are above their 50-day moving average, maybe they're like, I would say, more than 50% likelihood that in the near term, there will be some kind of mean reversion happening. So you can look at, you know, I posted this data on my website in terms of these cutoff ratios. So where the market is in this cut, when these cutoff happens, right? So like, for example, a couple of days ago, I posted on Twitter that, you know, my mean reversion indicator just showed up for the first time. It, basically, the number of tokens that crossing like 40-day or 50-day, I forgot which one is this, is crossing the 75% percentile on the upside. So for the first time in like a couple months, the last time it happened was in November, right? We had a small uptick in the market and then FTX happened immediately to the downside, right? So that was like exogenous event broke that trend. So, but then, you know, a couple of days ago, this started showing up again. So, which makes sense, right? Because since beginning of this month, we are at the, you know, third week of January right now. So since the first week of January, the past 2-3 weeks, crypto has been running up like nonstop. So yeah, so I think this makes sense, right? So in what the indicator starts to pick up.
So your indicator, when you say mean reversion, your indicator is saying maybe too many things are going up and it's time for a little break.
Yes, that's what it's basically saying. Now you can talk about, okay, because the percentile, because that indicator is just like statistical outliers, it's picking up, I look at like a past 5-6 years, what's the range of this indicator? So, and then when this, when that indicator goes above the 25 to 75% percentile, which is the ballpark, like normal part, when it becomes an outlier, then that signals some kind of turning point could be happening, right? Or could be happening soon. But the question is, we're talking about like, it still depends on like what the underlying market fundamental market environment is, right? So for example, at the beginning of, because these are statistical patterns, summary statistics, they're picking up like a both across different market conditions, across both bull and bear markets. So, but those markets can be very different, right? So, but when you were talking about, for example, at the beginning of the bull market, you have very, very strong buying power coming in into the market and really like hit the price out of the park, so to speak. And it can sustain itself for an extended period of time beyond what the cross-market condition average will suggest to you. So in that case, you know, that statistical outlier, it may stay there for an extended period of time. So I'm not saying once it indicator hits, you sure. know, upper bound or lower bound, the market will reverse immediately. I'm not saying that. If that is the case, then it becomes like a guaranteed way to make money, which is there's no such thing in the world. Okay. So it's just, investing, I see it as a game of probability, right? So it just helps you to gain some insight on probability. That's it.
It's interesting because I used to do a lot of quant related, both day trading and intermediate term trading, where I would look at these types of indicators. So for instance, let's take 2002. There were almost zero IPOs, so zero new issuance of shares, and like very few secondaries, zero IPOs. And so the literally the supply of shares on the market had been remaining the same, but demand for whatever reason was going up. And that's usually a good indicator that, okay, maybe the stock market's ready for an extended bull run. And then you could see how this applies on a monthly basis, weekly basis, daily basis, even indicators on a minute by minute basis. Like how much are these indicators like almost like fractals where no matter what the size, they still work. But there's always going to be cases, you know, where it works until it doesn't work anymore. And because what you're really modeling is almost institutional behavior, because that's what really drives massive moves, at least in the stock market.
Yeah, well, I would say it apply more to that institutional behavior, apply more to the stock market than the crypto market, because I mean, the crypto market is like $1 trillion right now.
Yeah, it's small. Okay. And speculators are still really involved in every move of the crypto market.
It's just a very small, and there is a limited institutional liquidity in the market compared to the traditional financial market. But still, I think the general principle is the same. You know, these indicators tells you give you some information about the some kind of turning, some kind of change that's happening in the market.
What about like the bigger picture in terms of, you know, yes, Ethereum's moved very quickly from, let's say, 1,100 to almost 1,600 the other day. And so maybe that's time for mean reversion, and plus a lot of other smaller tokens have gone up. So yes, maybe there's time for a little bit of a pullback or a big pullback, who knows. But what about overall, like if you broaden out the picture, you see almost every token, including Ethereum, Bitcoin, is more than, you know, 50% off its highs. In some cases, very legitimate tokens are 90% or more over off their highs. Does the indicator play a role there where, at least compared to a year ago, something like 100% of tokens are down or are below their, like, let's say, 200-day moving average?
You know, I would be very careful to apply some kind of value investing, like a perspective, to this type of market. Because that's almost sounds like what you're saying, you know, like you look at valuation and like solid projects, they're down so much. Because I feel like the value investing and crypto, those two are like, you put those two together, the two don't go together in my world. Okay. Because we are talking about a highly speculative market that has actually very little real-world traction yet. And all we are seeing is promise of the future, which is, you see the same thing. It's the same thing when you look at stock market, right? So there is growth stocks, you know, we just talked about at the beginning, the Moderna of the world and Tesla of the world. And then there's the value stocks, the, you know, I don't know, Johnson & Johnson, the Berkshire Hathaway. So you look at these things differently, right? For the growth stocks, they go up. They don't tend to go up because there is a solid fundamental behind it, but they go up because there is a very bright, perceived a very bright future.
You don't think that discounted cash flow analysis of both growth and value stocks would result in essentially the same figures? Because, like, take Tesla, and I'm not a fan either way of Tesla. I don't own it. I've never written about it.
Yeah, let's not talk about Tesla because it just pushes too many buttons and people are going to hate us. So
let's talk about like Amazon in 1999. All right. It was overvalued in 1999, or was it? Because what happens with a growth stock is if you try to do any kind of, okay, what is this company going to be making 20 years from now? Let's discount it back to today's value. With Exxon or Johnson & Johnson, it's very predictable. With Amazon, it's all just based on probabilities. Like, what's the probability the internet is going to grow to 1 billion users? It was at 50 million in 1999. What's the probability that Amazon's going to be the winner in e-commerce? So you factor all these things in and you try to do a more difficult kind of unpredictable discounted cash flow analysis. And, you know, Amazon, if you picked all your probabilities right, you would have made a lot of money. And if you were to say, okay, I don't know, it's hard to predict, then you would have stayed out of that and focused on value stocks.
I don't know how you could have done a cash flow analysis in 1999 for Amazon, because could you have foreseen the emergence of AWS, for example, which is the lion's share of their revenue now? Right. So, I mean,
you couldn't have foreseen that.
Yeah, so how could you even do that? So that's why I'm saying it's like value investing, cash flow, that kind of framework doesn't really apply to the growth stock or the ballpark of all the parts of the Web3 world, actually, because it's just a different framework, right? This is a very narrative-driven, where does the narrative come from? It's the narrative about how much the thing going to grow or going to explode in the future, with very little like empirical evidence in terms of cash flow behind it. That's why these things can be highly, highly volatile, because essentially they were driven by people's opinions, right? So you can say, okay, so if you had bought Amazon in 1999, but you could have bought a bunch of other things in 1999, right? So you look at, for example, Cisco, right? If you bought like a Cisco in 1999, you're still barely breaking even today. So
is that true? I don't even know.
So So it's a, you know, it's like same thing. You know, I was just chatting with my partner at WAGMI Ventures, which is with some friends there, because you know, we were doing like a angel syndicate for Web3. It's, if you look at, you know, all the like startup investing, there are some similarities with early stage investing, with like gross investing in like it's just the market is liquid and market is illiquid, but there is some underlying similarity there, which is if you look at the long term, it's very hard to pick winners, right? So it's 95% of startups fail, and a lot of these nowadays it's easier to get an IPO. So you get a lot of early stage companies in the public market as well. So, but the failure rate of those can be very high, right? And if you look back in hindsight, you can pick the winners. Okay, that 1, 2, 3 things went up 1,000%, but you know, the rest of 95% just sunk like a stone, right?
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, I, of course, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests. And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a three-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop. Really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Let me ask, like, in terms of valuation of tokens, you can look potentially, okay, what is the problem this token is trying to solve? What is the size of that market? You can start to look at, like, revenues. You know, some of these tokens are already making revenues. You know, some of the picks, if you think the crypto ecosystem is going to grow, and let's say your theory is, okay, it's going to replace to some extent or to every extent the financial ecosystem. So trading will happen only on DeFi exchanges, and like stocks will be converted with, you know, synthetic style tokens into crypto so they can be traded on DeFi exchanges. Then you could say, okay, the stock market or the market of derivatives is hundreds of trillions, and we can, you know, eventually the cryptos that are the picks and shovels that are going to build this ecosystem, they're all going to, you know, exchanges are going to need to buy them, and so their revenues are going to grow up, their cash flows are going to go up. Maybe you can do some type of company style analysis of cryptos that way.
Okay, so that's the exactly this kind of analysis that I prefer not do, because I don't think they fit quite much to the crypto world right now. What I'm trying to look at is what's the type of project that can that has at least a shot at gaining some kind of network effect. So this is what I talk. So at the beginning, we discussed we're going to talk about valuation, right? So maybe this is the right time to talk about that, because you can value the tokens with discounted cash flow, as you mentioned, you know, or some kind of revenue model. But you know, to me, if something is at this early stage, it's like, and you're talking about a longer term investment, you're looking at, you need to have similar to a venture capital mentality, right? So you have to look at, is this thing possibly like 1,000x or 100x? Yeah. Because your risk is extremely high, extremely high. So to achieve for any one of your investment, in order for you to achieve a positive expected return, if we are talking about like a binary scenario, either the thing go to the sky or the thing go to zero, which is very likely in early stage, you know, these new technologies projects, then you have to, that first scenario has to give a really high return in order to compensate for the zero scenario, which is a high probability scenario. Right. So then you're looking at, okay, does this thing has any potential to even go to 100x or 1,000x, without you know, necessarily being helped by a bubble scenario, right? So because basically that's why the venture capitalists they want to find the network style businesses and those that have really, really big market cap, TAM, the market size, right? So so that's why, you know, to me, like, I'm most interested in these like a platform style of projects in Web3, which is you know, layer one, layer two blockchains and some other select infrastructure projects.
So let's take Ethereum versus Bitcoin as an example. Ethereum, I would say, is more of a platform than Bitcoin, and it has the network effect. Like, the more people building projects on top of Ethereum, the more other people will have to adapt to Ethereum if they want to use those projects or if they want to participate as a consumer in those projects. Whereas Bitcoin, there's not as much network effect, because if someone's willing to pay in Bitcoin, it's not necessarily the case that other people have to pay or buy in Bitcoin.
Yeah, well, I think definitely, you know, any network. So these blockchain infrastructure, the network, how that happens mechanically is that you have people on the network, like, using the blockchain, and they are paying for transactions, right? So that transaction fee is paid in the native token, whether it's Bitcoin or Ethereum or something else. And then in order to be active on the platform, you have to hold a certain amount of that token. You could imagine a scenario where you do not hold a token balance in your wallet, but you just like, okay, today I need to make a transaction, so I immediately exchange some fiat currency or something else for this native token and then use that for a transaction. And then after that, I just immediately sell that token. But that kind of scenario, it's not, even that kind of scenario, you have to, there is a time window where when you are holding that positive balance of that native token in your wallet, right? So mechanically, more people are using the platform means more people need to hold at least some amount of that native token in their wallet. So as the volume of the as the volume of transaction grows, as the volume of users grow, that becomes that has proportional demand pressure, upward demand pressure on that token, right? So this is the way that I would tend to think about it in terms of how that network growth translates into the token price growth. This is very different from a valuation model where you deduce the token value from how much money the company is making.
Right. No. So I like this idea of looking at it in terms of like network effect, because then as something grows, the value of it grows exponentially, which is what you want when you're looking for 100x or 1000x returns. And so again, like, what are the platform style tokens? And like, I suppose any story could be told about any token, but like, it seems like, and I'm not, again, supporting one versus the other. I'm just thinking out loud, like Ethereum versus Bitcoin, which are the most well-known ones. Ethereum seems more platform-like, where when one person uses it and it gets successful with that one person, other people will have to use it, kind of that network effect. Bitcoin is not as much as a platform.
I'm not sure this is not like a telephone network, okay? It's not like one person uses it, so the other person has to use it. There's some component in that. But I think it's just once you have this worldwide network of where like people can transact and people can build like a programming logic on top, and it attracts certain amount of liquidity and attracts a certain amount of user base, and then that tend to self perpetuate. Most of the liquidity in the blockchain world, in the Web3 world today, is locked in like Ethereum compatible, applications. Either applications are built on Ethereum or built on some layer two of Ethereum, like Arbitrum or Optimism, something like that. In other words, like an EVM like chain, Ethereum virtual machine compatible chains. So, most of the liquidity is locked in this network, this ecosystem. All right. So, and then you think about like a new, that is a natural moat, natural competitive advantage, right? So, as a new blockchain platform, you have to go against that, right? Because as an application, if I'm like looking to build on top of a blockchain, I'm thinking about, okay, where does my liquidity gonna come from? Where does my user gonna come from? Am I going to go to a platform that already has a bunch of eyeballs and a bunch of users? Or am I going to go with a platform that starting from scratch? Maybe I'll go with the latter if I'm, sufficiently bribed to do so. That's why newer blockchains, they have these incentive programs for applications to build on them. It's similar to countries have tax credit for their foreign direct investments.
But this is like a telephone network. Like, okay, so like if the telephone network's built on Ethereum, but you want to call, if you want to call your friends on a telephone network that's not built in a certain way, you have to create your own new telephone network and you have to get your friend to use it as well.
Yeah. So I got it. So yeah, you're right. So in that sense, there is a similarity there. So, but if you like that, the kind of moat, really important, right? So, so I did this evaluation estimation. So basically modeling the market cap of a blockchain platform as a function of transaction, number of transactions, or the number of active users, which is a proxy for the amount of traction this platform has. And as a function of that, and also as a function of the moat of the platform, and also a function of the current state of the crypto market. Modeling the market cap as a function of platform traction, platform moat, and crypto market conditions.
How do you measure moat?
So the moat, because this is empirical, like it's a regression, right? So the moat is just simply a fixed effect in that panel regression. So the panel is a time series of different series. So we have like in this particular estimation, I have like 12 blockchains in this data sample. And then we have like a time series for each of the blockchain, right? So that is basically the fixed effect for each of the chain. Basically, it's one number for each chain. So you see that the older platforms like Ethereum and Bitcoin that have existed for a while, not very long, but at least longer than most in Web3, they have the higher moat factor, right? They have the higher coefficient for that moat because they've been around for a while and then people think they will continue to exist.
I'm just wondering, just in terms of statistically, would moat be correlated with number of users? Too correlated to be useful in the model?
No.
Okay.
No, it's a number of users is already taken care of by the platform. Yeah, it's already in the model. It's a separate thing from that number of user. It's the factor that's the platform specific factor that cannot be explained by the traction alone. So.
Okay. So because again, I'm trying to understand how you measure like Ethereum's moat versus, let's just make it up, like Solana's moat.
Number of
users would be a good
way to do that. The number of users is already in the model, but this is, again, this is a separate factor. It's like a price premium, you can think of it. A price premium in addition to what can be accounted for by the amount of traction of the platform. So if Ethereum has 5 users and Solana has 5 users, so they have equal amount of traction, let's say. But if an investor perceives that Ethereum is more has a higher moat, or it's more likely to continue to be around, in other words, safer, more secure, however you interpreted this, then you know people are willing to pay a higher price for it, to pay a markup for it. So maybe you are willing to pay $5 for Solana, you're willing to pay $7 for Ethereum, even though they have the same amount of users. That's what the moat factor measures.
Okay. So using these valuations, what are using this model, what surprised you? What came out of it?
So I ran this a while ago. Okay. So basically at the time I ran it, which is actually a month ago. But, you know, market has changed a lot just from a month ago because everything has pumped. So I'm not sure, like, what's the status for it right now. I haven't looked at it recently. But the time I ran it, so basically one way you can use this type of estimation is to look at what is the difference between the actual market cap right now of this platform versus what the model says, what the model would estimate it should be at this point in time, given the traction, given the moat, given the crypto market conditions, right? And then you can calculate the difference and you see, okay, for some of the tokens, the difference is pretty high. Like, for example, at the time I ran it for Polygon, that its actual market cap was like 40% higher compared to what the model had predicted at that time. Okay.
When you say 40% higher, like, are you able to backtest like all the other times it was 40% higher, it would revert to the mean, or
So you can see historically there is a very significant negative relationship between the quote unquote overvaluation and a subsequent performance. So meaning so this is from historical data, right? So if this platform today its actual market cap is so much higher than the predicted market cap by the model, in the following year, it tends to underperform the crypto market in general. Not saying that it would not underperform, meaning relative to the crypto market. Okay, so it still depends on crypto market conditions. I mean, like the market go up, it probably go up. Market go down, it will probably go down. But it's just like relative to the market.
Do you feel like long term though, ultimately, just like with Amazon, it was impossible to predict in 1999, and maybe Apple was as well. Ultimately, though, these things in the very, very long term do become, you know, analyzable because of cash flow, revenues, business model, you know, size of the market, you know, product market fit, all of these things. You know, what do you, since you, I know you're a believer in crypto long term, what are kind of the use cases that a lot of these bigger tokens are going to fit into that might justify, you know, higher and higher valuations, regardless of crypto market sentiment right now?
We are talking about a very early stage sector, right? So we were talking about actually biotech at the beginning of this conversation. It's really kind of similar. It's really kind of a similar deal in terms of where the space is, because you know, you have like every other day you see a new token, some new project doing something interesting. Sort of interesting. But you know, how much this thing will have in 5 years, 10 years, I don't know.
But like biotech.
Biotech's the same thing. You know, how many clinical stage biotech companies there are in the stock market? I mean, I actually counted the other day. Like I would say like, you know.
Of course you did.
Yes, like in the range of, I think that, and I forgot a number, but in the range of 1,000. Okay. So you think these like a clinical stage biotech companies are basically, you know, they have like a one or two ideas for a breakthrough drug. If they really break through, they're going to make it big, right? But higher chance is not going to break through. They're going to fail.
But we know the size of the use case is enormous. Like some biotech will win, some will lose.
Yeah.
And the technology gets better and better.
Yeah. So overall, I am like totally bullish about biotech, right? Because I know like in next 23 years, we're going to see some spectacular breakthroughs.
Yeah.
But just in terms of every single one of them, and also like people all see this, right? So, and also there's so many biotech companies, new like clinical stage companies out there, but most of them still are going to fail.
That's true, but nobody would say the industry is a fad. Whereas with crypto, some people say, let's say half of people in the world say, oh, this crypto thing is just a fad. And but no one says biotech's a fad, because we always see some successes and every year more diseases are cured and you know, people are hoping to live to 120 and so on. Because we trust that biotech is real. We just don't know about any one company. But crypto, there's in the way it's a little different than biotech is that maybe there's the exponential growth there, or maybe it's not. Just like with the internet in 1999, a lot of people thought it was a fad. It took until it had 1 billion users, let's say around 2005, before people said, oh, this is here to stay. So like, do you see that tipping point happening for crypto, or is there such a tipping point?
I feel like we already had tipping point. You know, we have like last year, I think the peak is like 350 million users worldwide, someone estimated.
But like the average person I know doesn't own any Bitcoin, for instance. And I don't know if we haven't reached the tipping point where zero people say this is a fad. Like I would say the internet didn't reach that point until, you know, everybody was really comfortable with putting their credit card numbers in and there were 1 billion users. Then people stopped saying the internet is a fad.
Yeah. Okay. So to you, 1 billion users will be a tipping point. That's what you're saying.
Maybe. Or in order to get to 1 billion users, you need a use case that will fit 1 billion users. So the use case of the internet was e-commerce and then maybe social media.
Yeah, so to me, the use case to get to 1 billion users, at least I think that's part of the piece of the puzzle, is some kind of a Web 2.5, you know, innovation in terms of using tokenization to combine it with some kind of a Web 2 model, Web 2 businesses. Like, for example, I'm advising this one company. Gosh, I don't know. I'm not supposed to disclose that, but let's just say,
let's not
talk about that particular one. But let's just say, for example, if like Uber, right? So that's the example I gave in like a recently, like wrote an article about that. So if like Uber tomorrow, there's a new, if Uber starts today, and the Uber wants to get to the critical mass very fast. So it can use tokenization as an incentive, as a growth hack, to help it to get to that stage faster. So instead of bribing users to join the platform with real cash, it can bribe users, with tokens. And that token will be a platform, hopefully, achieve some kind of platform, the payment medium status in the future, or in order for it to gain value in the future.
I agree with this model, but also, okay, let me just play the devil's advocate, because I totally agree with you that every company eventually needed a website, every company eventually is going to do kind of what you're describing, which is almost like a frequent flyer miles type of, you know, loyalty program. And the question is, why do they need, the question I get when I present this is, why do they need a decentralized platform? Why can't they just use a centralized, why can't Uber just make their own Uber miles and they have monetary value and they don't actually want you to, they don't want composability. They don't want it to be traded on some exchange because they want people to keep their Uber miles. So why does it need to be in a crypto format?
No, it doesn't have to, but the thing is, you're going to be pressured to do that if other people start doing that, right? So imagine if I'm the Uber, all right? I'm the Uber number one, and I have a token. Well, the people do that. It's like you said, it's the airline miles. I go to a supermarket, I go to a grocery store, and they give me points because I spent money there, and they give me some points so I can like get some rewards in the future. I don't know. But the thing is, that reward is like siloed, right? You only use it at Whole Foods, or I can only use it in a particular, supermarket chain or whatever.
But Whole Foods likes that.
Sure. Whole Foods like that. Yeah, airlines like that. But what if? But now we have the wallet platforms that are like worldwide liquidity available now, right? So imagine tomorrow another supermarket says, okay, we have the loyalty program, we'll give you points, but these will be tokenized so you can actually sell them if you don't want to use them today. So now the supermarket number two has an even more attractive loyalty program than supermarket number one, which is a point that you can only use it in that store. So supermarket number two now has a program that's more popular and they're more competitive. Now, what does the supermarket number one have to do? They have to jump on the bandwagon at some point, otherwise they lose competition.
That's a really great point. And if things are traded on markets like this, then at some point it drives up the price of the rewards for supermarket number two to so high that it's detrimental to use them. So then they switch back to supermarket number one. That's the incentive for supermarket number one to say, okay, yeah, you could start trading these on the market.
Well, the thing is, a token that has worldwide liquidity that is composable, that can be used outside of the application that issued them is a better featured product compared to a point system that is siloed within a single platform from a user point of view, right? It's a better featured product. Now, better featured product wasn't available 10 years ago, but now it is available. It is an option.
Yeah, and people always say crypto, oh, what's the value based on? It's a made up value. But in this case, the Uber case, there's an actual monetary value that could be assigned to an Uber coin because rides have a value. We know what the cost of a ride is.
Yeah, so you can think about the value of the token. It can happen in different ways, right? So one way is it becomes that token becomes a payment medium for that platform. And as that platform grows, it continue to, the token value grows with it. For some platforms, that token can be used to exchange for the products or services of whatever the platform offers. So that gives, in that sense, it's the same thing as the airline miles and or traditional loyalty programs, but that gives that token some value, right? So, but the thing is, actually, yesterday I was in this Twitter space and I was talking about this. For companies, it's like it's both a blessing and a curse, right? So it's a blessing because it's for newer companies now you have this additional more innovative tool as a growth hack. basically you can incentivize users without impacting your current day cash flow, essentially.
To your point, like that, this might be an incentive for more people to get involved in crypto if they think they could also bet. Like, which comes first, more users or companies like Uber creating these sort of crypto loyalty programs, even though there aren't the billion users yet, even though there's relatively few users in the United States?
Well, you got these two. I got to go. There's no, nothing comes first. It's equilibrium, right? It's the two move together. So, or, you know, move like in lockstep with each other. More eyeballs on crypto will attract more solid businesses to start thinking about tokenization or like a leveraged tokenization to drive their business in some way. And more businesses start doing that, it will drive more users to Web3. So these two like reinforce each other.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere. This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans. That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
And then what do you think it might be another like billion user use case? Like clearly, I would think trading of, you know, tokenization and trading of those tokens is going to be a big use case. Like, here, why can't I tokenize 5% of my house, for instance, and put it on an exchange where someone could trade their McDonald's stock in exchange for a token that represents 1/1,000,000th of 5% of my house? Like, it seems like many more things could be financial derivatives than currently are, because
There are projects doing that. You know, a lot of projects are working on the thing that you said, or similar to what you said. It's like fractionalize some kind of real world hard asset, like real estate, for example. Or fractionalize some kind of rental income stream, so on and so forth.
Why do you think someone hasn't done this before in a centralized way? And by the way, I'm a big believer that this is going to drive crypto usage, but the pushback I get is, okay, let's create a centralized database and a centralized company that does this. Why do you need crypto? And, you know, my point is, it's better with crypto, but how would you answer the person who says, hey, you can do all that with real estate with a centralized software and just focus on real estate?
Yeah, you totally could. You totally could. You know, someone would say, well, the value of crypto is that you have like a worldwide liquidity, right? So not only so because it's a borderless platform, public blockchains are borderless platforms. So if you have a house in Atlanta, you you have like companies like managing rental properties in Atlanta. You could sell it to some investors. That income stream can be sold to someone in Spain. So you could say like that like reduces transaction cost dramatically, right? So
ultimately, fundamentally, liquidity is the use case.
Yeah, liquidity is like a technology wise, it like reduces the transaction cost of this type of set of like investment income sharing. This, you know, transaction costs, but you can argue, wow, is the government going to allow that? Because this opens so many Pandora's boxes, right? So, so I don't have an answer to that question. I think this is way over the head of government right now. So, So it's this kind of thing is like you, if you allow that, you make any kind of like cross-border transaction flow, like a cross-border financial flows, very, very volatile, can be, has the potential to make any kind of cross-border financial flows very, very volatile. So that means it's just like adds more things to do for the government.
I sort of feel like all that gets solved ultimately. Like people said the same thing about the internet in 1995, like, well, the phone the government will protect the phone companies. The phone companies will never allow to make people will never allow people to make phone calls through the internet. And of course, the government really couldn't do anything to stop it because it is borderless. So it grows faster than the government's ability to be aware of the problem.
Yeah, well, but the government still need to deal with the problem eventually, right? So in this case, if your cross-border financial transactions are very volatile, it becomes a huge hassle to manage your currency, for example. Your currency, because you think about like you still have a real world economy, right? So you still have real world trades that need to happen. You buy and sell stuff, export, import in the real world, physical world, and that requires some certain kind of stability for your currency to in order to not disrupt that kind of real world transactions, real world exchanges, right? So if you it's especially if you're a smaller country, it's a more of an issue. And then like because you have to export, you have to import, and there's a currency conversion going on. If that currency conversion values changes dramatically, it really can be huge disruption to your domestic economy, the real world economy. On the other hand, you have all these financial flows, and those financial flows, they're all happening intangible in the digital world. They have a huge impact on your currency value, which means even though that part has nothing to do with real world economy, it will affect your real world economy. If that financial flow becomes a whole lot more volatile, it makes your job a whole lot harder to actually, keep your economy, real world economy stable, right?
I think that's why there might be a race among smaller countries to become kind of crypto centers, like get the banking, laws in place, get the regulations in place, and then have crypto banks, crypto exchanges based in places like Ireland or Dubai or, some island or whatever.
I do not see most countries going that route. It's like, I would say like, smaller countries, select countries, but you look at the Bahamas, that's the route they went, right? They attracted FTX. Yeah. Good for them.
Yeah, didn't work out so well.
So these, because smaller countries, they have less to lose, obviously. And, they would tend to go for these experimental measures. But, is that a worldwide trend? I do not see it yet. But the thing is that it really makes the government's job harder if you have very volatile cross-border flows. You have, for example, in the past year, U.S. dollar hugely appreciated against emerging market currencies. So as a result, at least one of the factors that had led to all the emerging market countries have to raise their interest rates, even though their domestic economy was not that strong. So, but they were really in a bind because dollar appreciated so much because, and they have a free floating exchange rate. So that really they have to defend their currencies to a certain extent by really tagging the Federal Reserve to raise interest rate. Otherwise, they will have to have a huge portfolio outflows. So, that's without the kind of cross border network like blockchains that has unlimited financial, cross border transaction capacities. So if you have if you open up to these cross-border transactions through blockchains, it's going to make that part, those financial flows way more volatile.
And I guess harder to track as well. Like You won't, yeah. Right now, we know how many dollars are going in and out every single day.
Yes. But
you wouldn't necessarily know that in a crypto world. So you mentioned the Federal Reserve. I'm curious if you think the negatives are outweighing the positives in terms of them raising rates.
Well, they raised rates. They should have, and they did the right thing. Inflation was very high and the economy was very strong. The rate was very, very low and after COVID. So that was the right thing to do. So I don't see what is the problem there.
Maybe you have to kind of decide which part of the inflation is related to money supply growth, which part of the inflation is temporary because nobody was buying lumber for 2 years. So they stopped cutting down trees for 2 years. And now eventually that comes back and then the price of lumber goes down and so on. Same thing with the effects of the Russia-Ukraine war. There's some temporary inflation.
So I think we talked about this last time, right? So according to some estimates, it's half and half. Half of the inflation in the U.S. was supply-driven, like supply chain problems, for example. Half of it was a demand factor. So the demand factor could be, you know, related to the excessive money supply growth right after COVID. It's a mix of things, basically.
So what do you basically think happens next? Like, are they going to stop reducing rates as much? Or like, what's your personal opinion?
For this year, I mean, the general expectation is they're going to, stay the course, say what they said they were going to do, basically raise some more, but there's no like additional in addition to what they have already announced. So that's the expectation in general. And I think that's a valid expectation because inflation is coming down, may not be coming down to the target range of Federal Reserve very, very quickly in the short term, but it is coming down. On the other hand, the economy is softening. You know, you've seen some like retail numbers coming in. You have some like companies posting earnings. You start to see some pretty significant downward surprise in earnings. But in general, economy is softening, inflation is coming down, but inflation is not down, you know, not there yet. And employment numbers are still holding up really well. So I expect they will continue tightening, but it will not be as steep. It will be softer, milder compared to what they did in the last year. So the tightening path that they have already announced, I expect them to be executed, but that's already expected by the market.
And do you think, given that it's expected by the market, do you think, and I think a lot of the reason the crypto market has fallen so much since November 2021 is that A, you know, that's when the Fed started really signaling that they were going to be raising rates quite high for some time. So the crypto markets panicked, the stock markets panicked, real estate panicked. Do you think now expectations are more built in? And we could see another, you know, a significant crypto move upwards, or what's your feeling on that?
I it's tricky to make these predictions. I don't know how significant it will be, but I expect it to be a more stable market compared to last year for sure.
Well, Tasha, as always, like you're so intelligent. Your analysis of all these situations is so intelligent. It's always a pleasure to have you on the podcast. I read everything you write, and I think everyone else should too. How can people sign up for your newsletter, which is so, again, so valuable?
Yeah, so it's a free newsletter about Web3 and macro in general. You can go to tashalabs.com/newsletter to sign up. But thank you so much. This has been super fun.
Yeah, I always enjoy talking to you. And thanks again.
Thanks.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.